Look at Peter. Okay, welcome to Martian Driving Podcast number, whichever number I decide to give it in post-production. My name is Terry Frost and I host the show, and I have a guest this time, Grant Watson from Fiction Machine. How are you, Grant?
I'm actually really good.
That's good. So we're doing this live with an audience of six. Now, when Galactic Suburbia was in here just beforehand, there were like 80 people in the room. Now, there are six. So to those 74 people, fuck you. By the way, language warning. Okay. what we're going to do is we're going to noodle around. We've got 2 hours to play with here, so if we stuff it up, we can always try again. And we're going to be talking about the Avengers Age of Ultron, amongst other things. So let me get my little Iron Man book where I've written all my show notes on. By the way, who has seen Avengers Age of Ultron? You had your hand up first. You get a copy of The Italian Job. I'm giving away things to
you. Is that the actual Italian Job? Or
that's the proper one. That's not your Mark Wahlberg rubbish.
Yeah, it's your proper Michael Caine.
Italian Job. Okay, yeah. So, here you go. Pay attention because there will be other prizes as well. So I've got the Iron Man book here, see? Iron Man notebook.
That is a very attractive notebook.
It is. And now I've written in it and totally spoiled it.
I love visual props on podcasts.
Yeah, I know. That's
they
why I
like an element of mystery.
That's why I wore my Avengers pajama top too, because audio podcasting being such a graphic medium.
I could describe my incredible Hulk cosplay.
I like the fact that you bulked up for it as well. You've really been hitting the roids, and you know that torn shirt thing really works for you.
Well, it's the attention to detail that I think is important.
Absolutely.
In an audio medium.
Yeah, so I should explain the podcast for those who came in lately. Martian Driving Podcast is kind of a split-off podcast from my other podcast, Paleo Cinema. When I got Paleo Cinema to 100 episodes, I decided that I needed to do a podcast more for genre stuff on the off chance that somebody would nominate me for an award. That has yet to occur. But anyway, I wanted to kind of keep genre stuff separately so I could talk about more recent genre works as well, while keeping Paleo Cinema's format of movies more than 20 years old going. So that's pretty much it. I'll do anything from Georges Méliès to Michael Bay, though. Unless you pay me a lot of money, I'm not doing Michael Bay.
There's not a single Michael Bay movie that you like?
I'm trying really hard to think of one.
I have a lot of time for The Rock, apart from one or two lines of dialogue.
Yeah,
Ed Harris is a great villain in that.
And also Sean Connery balances out Michael Bay, but this is before Michael Bay
became like Michael Bay as a sort of a style, if you like.
Michael Bay as a lack of style, rather than as a style. But yeah, I mean, Michael Bay movies, problematic for me. Occasionally I'll download them illegally because I would not pay for them, but then I'll watch about 20 minutes of them and delete them, because watching a Michael Bay movie, particularly the Transformers movies, is like being an insect on the front bumper of a car that's colliding with another car. All it is like big chunks of metal flying around. You don't understand what the fuck is going on.
It's funny because I'm 38, so I'm kind of at the perfect age to have watched the Transformers cartoon as a kid and bought all the toys. Mm. And so I had this great sort of nostalgic love for the characters. And so I actually really quite enjoyed the first of Michael Bay's Transformers movies, purely as an exercise in nostalgia.
Yeah.
But then I made the mistake of seeing 2 in the cinema, which was awful. And then I made the worst mistake of seeing 3 in the cinema, which was even more awful for different reasons.
Yeah.
And so the fourth one I tried watching on a plane last year. I figured, you know, I've got nothing else to do. I'm trapped in a box in the air. So watch that. I actually couldn't understand what was going on. And it's not one of those cases where you often get people who they see a movie, they think it's stupid, and so just sort of as a glib thing, they go, I couldn't even understand what they were doing. I actually couldn't understand what was happening in the movie.
It's a Mark Wahlberg movie as well, because Michael Bay and Mark Wahlberg together means totally incomprehensible. Unless Mark Wahlberg is working with an animated teddy bear, there's absolutely nothing interesting he ever does.
I'm trying to think. I'm sure this. I did like him in The Departed.
He was okay in Boogie Nights, but even his penis wasn't real in that.
I think it depends on the director he works with. If he's got a very strong director, he's an actor, you can get a very strong performance out of.
I'm yet to be convinced of him being a good actor.
That's fair enough.
He's a little like a few other people around where I've seen him. I mean, Ryan Gosling, I can't understand a lot of Ryan Gosling because it's like every facial muscle he ever had was paralysed.
Yeah, but he's very pretty. I think that's the key to Ryan Gosling's appeal, is that he's very pretty.
Yeah, well, if you want pretty, you can do a Fassbender, But anyway, we've digressed. By the way, speaking of aeroplanes, I'm going to try this. Next week I'm flying to Perth. Sal and I are flying to Sydney and then flying to Perth.
Cool.
And I'm going to try to do a podcast on the aeroplane using my portable podcast recorder, talking about movies like Airport and Airport 77 and Zero Hour and Airplane and basically air crash movies.
So when we hear about your arrest on the news.
Yeah.
And a plane diverted back to Sydney.
I think I can do it. I've got the nice Zoom Z2N, which is this microphone that people can see in front of me in the audience. I've got good filtering software so I can get a sound level and knock out all the external noise. And to kill the 5 hours flying to Perth, 4 or 5 hours from wherever it is from Sydney, I'm going to sit there and just mumble into the microphone and see if I can get a podcast out of it, because I need to get a few backed up.
That actually sounds like a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, it's stunt podcasting. I've invented the concept of stunt podcasting. I did it years ago because I actually recorded part of a paleo cinema while driving in a car across the Westgate Bridge.
The Newton Mass one.
Yeah. I did that. I had a headphone mic on and a laptop in the passenger seat because I didn't have quite the portable technology I have now, and just waffled about shit driving across the Westgate Bridge. So I'm going to take it to a new level.
If we, as your audience,
yes,
because obviously I'm one of your supporters on Patreon.
You are. We'll talk about our Patreon in a moment.
Oh, okay, cool. Because yep. I was about to say, if anyone's listening who hasn't, you know, pledged you money on Patreon, they should, because I think Patreon's an awesome system.
Yeah, because basically next week I'm retiring on all those Patreon millions.
Millions.
But
I'm just wondering, if we raise you enough money, can we get you to record a podcast while plummeting out of an aircraft with a parachute? Like, we paid for you to do the skydiving experience.
I'm 135 kilos. I've got to lose 35 kilos before they let me do that. So it's going to have to be a lot of money. But what I was thinking is, like, International Space Station is the next step, because I'm going up to, like, 10,000 metres. The only thing above that...
I thought you were about to say, I'm going up to the International Space Station.
No, well, you know, what I need to do is get one of those software billionaires to stake me to fly to the International Space Station so that I can podcast on the way up going... all the way up to the International Space Station. It's natural progression.
I really like the guys in the International Space Station. So was it Chris Hadfield who sang the Space Oddity?
And, that,
and now we've had one of the female astronauts has done Captain Janeway cosplay from Star Trek Voyager in orbit.
That not unattractive Italian lady. Yeah.
Yeah, so that stuff impresses me.
Yep.
Astronauts with senses of humour.
Yeah, because the whole idea of the whole right stuff thing was they weren't allowed to express themselves as personalities, and we've got to the stage now where they can.
That's, I remember the other one. They recently watched Gravity as their in-station movie.
Yeah.
And tweeted about it, asking if it qualifies as horror if you're on the International Space Station at the time.
Yeah. I've got problems with Gravity, but I won't talk about them now. But anyway, Grant.
Yes.
We're going to talk about your Patreon first and what stuff you're doing. So give us a little blurb about you.
Okay, very briefly, I am currently... my main creative project in the world is a website called fictionmachine.com. All lowercase, obviously. It's basically just a series of essays about the making of films that I find interesting, or people who've supported me on Patreon have found particularly interesting. So there's been a couple that, you know, that I've been sort of sponsored, if you like, to write about. But it's basically just picking a film that I think it's worth knowing how it was made and whether or not it works, and just writing a few thousand words about that. So.
And also TV series. You're doing TV series.
Oh, that's on another blog at the moment, The Angriest, which is my personal non, you know, Patreon-funded blog. Okay, so throw out whatever I want.
My question is this.
Yeah.
You're writing non-fiction in something called Fiction Machine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's looking at like the idea is behind the first thing is I just own the name, and I thought it was a cool name, like I own the domain name.
Yeah.
But it's looking at the mechanics of film narrative cinema. So how do they actually put it together technically to tell you a story? So that's where kind of Fiction Machine gets justified as a title. But I just mainly think it sounds
even cool. If it didn't, I wouldn't care. But yeah, that's all good. Probably. By the way, there will be spoilers about Avengers: Age of Ultron. So. If there was anybody that didn't put up their hand earlier... Or anyone listening now, there will be spoilers. And there will be F-bombs dropped occasionally. But we probably won't drop any C-bombs because we're not going to talk politics. But what have you been watching lately?
I'll tell you, this is completely not even in the same ballpark as Age of Ultron. The last thing I watched was a British film called Captured from 1959.
Remind me, I think
it's
I know.
It's basically a documentary filmmaker named John Krish in 59 was hired by the British Army to direct a documentary training film explaining to British soldiers what the likely things would happen if they were ever captured by an enemy in war.
Okay.
And to research it, they gave him all of the intelligence files they had on Chinese and North Korean interrogation and torture techniques during the Korean War. He then decided that he wanted to move, at the same time, he wanted to move out of documentaries and into making like narrative features.
Yeah.
And so he thought he could use this as an excuse to basically make a showreel to show all the various sort of film producers in Britain what his skills were like with drama. So he convinced the army to let him basically make it as a 60-minute drama about a bunch of British prisoners of war getting tortured and interrogated by the Chinese.
Okay.
Except because he's based it on actual documented cases and evidence, the final film is so... It's not graphic, but it's incredibly, incredibly direct and blunt. This is exactly what happens. There's a prolonged scene of waterboarding. There's a lot of psychological torture. When he finally handed in his film, the army brass were so incredibly horrified, they slapped it with a secret classification, and cool. No soldiers were shown it, and nobody in the public saw it for another 45 years.
So basically, everybody that watches it turns into the Manchurian Candidate.
Oh, it's a fantastic film, though, because it's only 60 minutes long, so it's like a really depressing version of The Great Escape, where no one comes even close to escaping.
Okay, well, yeah, I can see it being a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, but the BFI in the UK has basically just released a really, you know, bells and whistles package of it.
They're doing everything from like highbrow things
to
cheapo exploitation movie from the early 60s, the BFI Flashback, I think it is.
Flashback or Flipside?
Flipside.
I think this actually is from their Flipside range.
It's showing some really quirky stuff, like early 1960s strip club dramas and all sorts of other things like that. The interstitial stuff that didn't really hit anybody's radar big time.
Yeah, I think that stuff's really important to release because it's often the stuff that slips through the cracks or doesn't get restored properly or maintained.
I mean, just from my own life. Because I started going by myself to movies in the early
70s. Yeah.
And I did see class movies like Cabaret and all those kind of A-picture stuff.
Yeah.
But there's a ton of interstitial stuff that was released, you know, in the cinemas in Australia when they were trying to stop the cinemas from dying. And a lot of that stuff people just don't know. But when you mention it on Facebook or other social media, they go, oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
And things like that. So there's a whole history of... And they're quite popular. There are a lot of popular exploitation films in Australia, not just in drive-ins, but in hardtop cinemas.
Yeah.
The poshest cinemas in Sydney were showing titty films in the 1970s just to try to keep the cinemas going as a viable business. And there's a whole history of that that hasn't been written yet.
Yeah.
But, I like that stuff.
So what about you? What's the last good thing you saw that wasn't The Avengers?
I did see, for my radio gig, the ABC local radio NT gig, with Liz is back from having the flu because she didn't think she needed a flu shot. We saw Two for the Road with Albert Finney and Audrey Hepburn, Stanley Donen film from 1977. Great movie.
Mm.
It's about a marriage. It's a story of 12 years in a marriage, in a relationship. And all they show you is their trips to the south of France every summer. So it starts out where they meet in the south of France and the relationship and the love develops. Goes all the way through having a child and infidelity and all sorts of things like that. They've got some really nice character actors. Eleanor Bron's in it as well. William Daniels, who plays the voice of Kit in Knight Rider, is in there. And a whole bunch of other people. But you've got these two incredibly charismatic actors playing off each other. And there's some devastating bits of drama and there's some bits of comedy in there. And it's a really nice piece of 60s cinema. The trailer for it shows it being really kind of a rom-com.
Yeah.
But it's got two or three layers of depth under that and some really good writing by Frederick Raphael, which, you know, shows it to be a much more complex thing. So Liz and I did that and we both liked it. It's the third Audrey Hepburn movie we've done. So we're not doing Audrey Hepburn movies until like 2020 now. And we both enjoyed that thoroughly. And the other thing I did, which died in the arse for fairly obvious reasons, a lady called Rebecca McLaren was doing the radio gig with me. And because it's the like millionth anniversary of the Goons for me, the first Goon show, we decided we'd do a Peter Sellers movie. So just off the top of my head, I said, The Party. And then I remembered it was in blackface, brownface. And that kind of took us in a different direction. Yes, everybody was talking about Bertie Num-Nums and all those little gags and the visual gags in The Party and all that kind of stuff. But what we then went to look at was, I thought about it and I thought, why could it not have been a B-class English actor that Peter Sellers was playing rather than an Indian character? Like a subcontinental Indian guy with the blackface and the Buddhism and all that kind of thing, or the Jainism or whatever he's got. It would have worked just as well because the comedy would work as well, the clumsiness would work as well. And that was a lot to Monsieur Hulot's Holiday and things like that. But the escalation of the chaos was the thing that got me. I really liked that in that movie, where it starts out where his shoe gets a bit of mud on it and he tries to wash it off in this indoor pool, and the shoe washes away and he's got to try to get it again, to the whole house being trash, basically.
Yeah.
And I love the escalation of the comedy in that. But we agreed that there's certain kinds of comedy that time has come and passed. And we kind of, you know, had an agreement on that, that it's probably not good for that gig to do too many of those, because we also did Revenge of the Nerds because we wanted to do a teen comedy. And we did Revenge of the Nerds and found out that all of the nerds were basically sex criminals.
Yeah.
They took videos of girls in their locker rooms. One of them pretended to be somebody else so it could get laid.
It's not a likable movie.
Yeah, it's kind of a nasty movie. And then we did Real Genius the week after, and Real Genius does it right, probably because Penelope Spheeris directed it.
Mm.
And it's got strong female characters, and it's got that same kind of nerd culture, but done in a way that's not icky and obnoxious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we balance things out there. And that's the nice thing about the radio gig. When you fuck it up, you can find something to balance it up as well. But we're doing that. But anyway, we're talking about The Avengers Age of Ultron. Now, everybody's seen the movie now, pretty much. Tony Stark accidentally creates an AI, Ultron, played by James Spader, who has daddy issues big time. Tries to take over the world, rips off Andy Serkis's arm. They have a comeback and decide that the nice thing they decide, of course, is that the science fixes things.
Yeah.
I love that, the fact that they don't just go, no, there are things men was not meant to know, in a kind of how's those kind of way. But they decide to fix it with science. Now, I've got some frivolous questions, and then we can talk in depth about whether the Marvel Cinematic Universe has jumped the shark or not.
Okay.
Here's my question, and you can try to answer these.
Oh, okay.
Is Captain America entitled to a veteran's pension? He's 100 years old, nearly.
That's a good
question. World War II veteran.
I suspect he'd refuse one, though.
I'm not asking you whether he refused one. I'm asking you whether he should be...
I'm just wondering if that makes it a moot point, because even if they were trying to work it out, he'd be like, no, no.
Or would he be considered...
It's enough just to serve, sir.
Would he be, like, AWOL for not being around for the last...
That's the point. He might just be due to go to prison.
No, I mean, you could argue the point that he was actually fighting the war when he hit the drink and froze to death. But, so we're going to go with a yes or a no on whether Captain America...
Technically, I think, yeah. I don't think there's anything in the language of the laws that would require him not to be.
That
so,
doesn't
yes,
mean,
probably
that doesn't
is
mean
on a pension
much,
if he wants to be.
It doesn't mean as much in America where they treat their veterans like shit.
Hmm.
But it was just a question there. Okay, and here's another one. Did Ultron just need a hug?
One of the things I actually found really... This is weird. Before I say anything specific about the film, overall, I did enjoy myself watching.
I did too, yeah.
But I had huge quantity of problems. Like, the more I thought about it afterwards, the more things I suddenly realised annoyed me. And one of the ones that annoyed me actually was Ultron as a character.
Yeah, I think it's... They concentrate on the physicality and the voice, but there's not a layering there.
There's not a layering. And also his dialogue is very Joss Whedon, and that kind of...
Yeah,
I don't know. I wouldn't give him a hug just because I didn't particularly like
it. There are times
like
when, and I don't mean any disrespect to any gay people, there was times when the dialogue was almost like bitchy queen dialogue.
Yeah, I can see.
You see what I mean?
I just found it very kind of, you know, yeah, like whatever, kind of Joss Whedon, you know, everything's very casual and, you know, licked with that, you know, that kind of sound. Right the way through his dialogue, and every line he had seemed to be just overly florid with that sort of Whedonisms, if you want to call them that.
Yeah, because I do think Ultron's the kind of weak man in the room, almost in the movie. And why did they get Andy Serkis to play a South African? Was Sholto Copley not available?
He probably wasn't available, wasn't he, doing that show Powers?
Yeah, Powers. I don't actually mind Powers. I've watched it.
Yeah, I
really should talk about it at some stage.
Also, I suspect Andy Serkis might have just wanted to not perform a role covered in small dots.
Well, yeah, that's it. And I like Andy Serkis as an actor. I think he's got incredible versatility, apart from doing the physicality of the mocap acting.
Yeah.
I like Andy Serkis as an actor. He's got a range as a character actor. But the CG mocap stuff has drawn our attention away from that.
Yeah, and I agree.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll come back as Ulysses Klaue again in the next Avengers movie, because it's nice having people who aren't pretty.
I think you'll almost certainly see him in Black Panther whenever that comes out, 2017 or whatever.
I'm looking forward to that too, because I like Black Panther and I like Doctor Strange, and we're getting Tilda Swinton and Doctor Strange playing the Ancient One.
Yeah, I read that. That makes me very excited. She's one of my favourite actors.
I'm just wondering whether she uses the same makeup she had in Grand Budapest Hotel.
She kind of could.
Yeah, you can almost do it.
Different character.
Or she played the really old lady who was nailing Ralph Fiennes.
I really liked Tron that.
You haven't seen it yet, have you?
I have, but it was on a plane and it was a very small screen.
It's funny because, like, on the small screen, it would be almost impossible because she's... Yeah.
The makeup was fantastic. I'll give it that. It was top quality.
You physical. Can't see it in the makeup and you can't read the credits.
My advice would be to see it again if you get the opportunity on a larger format, because the beauty of the movie probably was diminished by that screen. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too, because I've been a Doctor Strange fan since way, way long ago.
Yeah, me too.
And I love the psychedelia of the Steranko artwork and the Ditko artwork and all that kind of stuff. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how they manifest that in a movie form. I've got one more question, which we probably should leave till towards the end of it.
Okay.
But the balancing act that is the Marvel Cinematic Universe, this is something that really fascinates me. Nobody's really tried to do a mosaic movie series like this, where you have different characters and different storylines that all come together in quite the way that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is doing it right now. And... has it jumped the shark with Age of Ultron, or is it just a cautionary thing where they probably need to stop and move forward?
I personally think that Marvel Studios are kind of sitting on the edge of a cliff at the moment. Mm. One of my biggest problems with Age of Ultron is that it felt like I wasn't watching a self-contained film anymore. And it was really the first of the Marvel movies. I think it's the 11th film in the series, all the Marvel ones. Yeah. So the first 10, even though they were interconnected and they followed up and they kind of linked together and bounced off each other to an extent, they still all felt like reasonably self-contained, you know, summer popcorn flicks.
Yeah.
Whereas this one felt like I was watching a two-hour advertisement for the next 3 years of Marvel movies. So the only reason they go to Wakanda and the only reason you see Ulysses Klaw is because they're leading into Black Panther. The only reason that you see Steve Rogers and Tony Stark start trying to, you know, have these massive angry moral debates with one another is because they're leading into Captain America Civil War.
Yeah, there is that. And it felt a bit like, you know, the Royal Variety Command performance thing where the royals sit up in the box and every star comes out and does a little piece.
Yeah.
And they all come in the end and take a bow.
Yeah.
It's got a little feel of that where they were trying to cram too many characters in there.
Thor's actually probably the most egregious one for me because the only reason Thor appears to be in the movie is to do a prologue for the next Thor movie. And they could have actually excised the character from the film entirely and had a stronger film.
Yeah. One thing I do like, though, is Chris Hemsworth acting gets better every movie.
He
started out fairly ordinary as a pretty boy, but, you know, with a little bit of guts to him. But I saw, I think, is that Drive? It's not Drive. What's that movie? Rush, I think.
Rush. It's the Ron Howard.
He was great in that. He was fantastic in that. And I saw Black Hat, the Michael Mann movie, which is an atrocious movie.
Yeah, everyone says that. I've kind of been avoiding it because
Hemsworth's
of the buzz.
Good in it.
Okay.
I like Hemsworth in it playing, you know, he plays an American, so the accent becomes a little bit of dissonance for me. But I like Hemsworth as an actor. I think that as he gets older and less pretty, I think he's going to be one of those guys that gets a great second career as a character actor.
Yeah, I'd hope so. I mean, he seems like a really... if you see him in interviews, he seems like a nice enough guy that I'm kind of hoping he has a long career.
And he does things on the quiet too. I know, because I have a lot to do with the radio in the Northern Territory, he lived up there with his family for 6 months. So he's been basically giving supplies to Indigenous school kids for sports events and things like that, and just doing stuff on the slide, which they only ever found out about because some kid put it on his Facebook.
Yeah.
So it wasn't done as a publicity stunt or anything like that. It was done totally because he loves the territory, he loves the people up there, and he wanted to give back to a community that was nice to him. So I've got a lot of time for Hemsworth as an actor and as a person, and I want to see him go from strength to strength. But, there are bits of the movie I had a problem with, like the bit of the way they're going to destroy the world is to lift up a chunk of an Eastern European city and slam dunk it into the planet.
Yep.
Doesn't seem the best way to go about that in a way, you know?
I liked that part of the climax. I thought that was actually an interesting enough idea, and it was kind of visually cool to see this huge city chunk slowly rising into the air. I just found my problem with the climax was more that it was just the Avengers fighting. Instead of fighting a bunch of sort of cyborg aliens in waves, they were fighting a bunch of robots in waves, but still in some city streets. It felt a little bit like deja vu.
And I think
the climax.
But the interesting thing too there is, as a reaction against Man of Steel not giving a fuck about civilians, they tended to overcompensate by giving you slightly too much of a fuck about civilians. You see what I mean? They were reacting to DC's things and saying, no, we're not going to do it that way. What we're going to do is we're going to make sure that everybody gets rescued that we possibly can, even if we've got to throw them up into a car.
They did that in the first Avengers movie that predated Man of Steel.
Yeah, but I think it was overemphasized in the second one for that reason, because One of the big problems I had with Man of Steel, apart from all the other big problems I had with Man of Steel, was...
Don't get me started.
Nobody gives a fuck about the civilians. It was just one of those things where, yeah, let's turn a city into pumice.
It's funny, watching the climax of Man of Steel, it's hard to imagine that that scene could not have occurred without a body count in terms of, you know, just people in that city of about, you know, 100,000 people.
100,000 plus easily, yeah. And it didn't add to the drama at all either, which is the other thing. It was all the bad drama was the character stuff in the foreground, all the bashing down the city parts. I mean, if you're Superman, right, you come in there and you're fighting a guy just as powerful as you, you're going to drag this bugger into a desert.
Yeah.
Your first thought is going to be drag him into a desert, have a fight out there. Kind of the way they did when they were attacking the Hulk in the Ugly Hulk.
Well, even if you want to stick with Superman, if you go back to the original Superman 2, yeah, like the Christopher Reeve one,
yeah,
like that's a core part of the fight in the city, is the fight ends pretty fast because they start threatening civilians and Superman can't fight them because he wants to save the civilians.
Yeah.
So they actually make that the core of the scene, and of course Christopher Reeve does such a great job playing Superman and that sort of strong moral centre, that becomes a really, really cool dramatic sequence, even if you go back and watch it now, whereas Man of Steel, it is just a bunch of visual effects punching each other for 20 minutes.
Yeah, and that's it, and Superman and Clark Kent are not as interesting a character in Man of Steel as well. It's kind of like someone from Deadliest Catch just happens to be a super powerful alien.
Yeah.
It's got that part working for it. My theory is that because the Marvel Cinematic Universe is doing something nobody's ever done before,
yeah,
there are going to be missteps because the path isn't well laid out. You're making it up as you go along. There are literally billions of dollars at stake. You got Disney on your back saying you can't have toys with girls in them.
Yeah.
And all those things which kind of... And you're trying to make money and trying to have a successful movie and an interesting movie with that kind of shit going on in the background. And I'm not blaming Joss Whedon for that at all. I'm blaming the studio and the guys running it, because it is overwhelmingly guys running those areas of studios who don't think that people want girl toys. I mean, I'll give you an example. I went to the cinema down at High Point.
Yeah.
In Melbourne, and they had a vending machine selling funky 3D glasses. You can get them for like $10 each.
Yeah.
And they had all the Avengers ones. And I thought I could see the Black Widow ones, but they were turned facing the other way, and they turned out they were just Thor glasses because I wanted to get Sal a pair of 3D Black Widow glasses. Yeah. Couldn't get them. They didn't have them in the vending machine. They had them up on the marquee, but they weren't in the vending machine.
Is that because they sold out really fast? Because everyone's so desperate for Black Widow merchandise, they'll take whatever they can get. All the slots were there. Oh, okay.
It's just that they hadn't bothered to make many of them. And that kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, Black Widow, she's one of the most interesting characters in there.
I thought this film actually did a really, really good job with Black Widow.
And like I've said on social media, her and Banner are a good match in some ways because they're the most damaged characters in some ways. Banner can destroy a city full of people accidentally.
Yeah.
And she was designed to be a monster.
Yeah.
And had monstrous things happen to her in her childhood and young adulthood.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
From which she's walking away. So there's a depth of character there that really doesn't get much sunlight.
Yeah, and I found the scenes between the two of them was some of the strongest stuff in the movie for me personally. I had a lot of resonance to it. It felt very naturalistic, and also it was an angle that I'd honestly never thought of before to pair those two, and I don't think the comics have ever considered pairing those two characters.
And the interesting thing too was that Scarlett Johansson in that bar scene was incredibly sexy in an old school film noir.
It was a very sort of classy, old fashioned kind of
thing. Yeah, it wasn't like, you know, wrap your ankles around the back of someone's neck kind of way, but in a kind of classy, the dialogue is the flirtation.
It was that scene, the scene in the bar. It's really weirdly framed though, because she's wearing kind of like a sort of, I remember the colours are quite stark, like black and white or whatever her outfit is.
Hmm.
But she's standing at one side of a bar and there's a shelf of booze behind her.
Yeah.
And she's mixing herself a cocktail.
Yeah.
But as Bruce Banner walks up, it completely looks like her job at this party for the Avengers is to make all of the other Avengers cocktails. And given that the way Hollywood tends to treat their female characters, I instinctively assumed that's what they were doing. So for the first 30 seconds of that scene, I was actually getting quite angry at the movie, going like, oh, the typical Hollywood.
But that's not what was happening. It's just the way that they edited it.
Yeah.
And they probably cut out maybe a couple of seconds to save time.
Yeah.
Which would explain it a lot better. But I think they're a good match. I mean, the only problem with that is, of course, how does the physical relationship go? Because if you remember back to the stupid Edward Norton Hulk.
I like the Edward Norton Hulk. I still prefer Edward Norton as Banner.
Still going to call it the stupid Edward Norton Hulk. When you go back to that, him and Betsy Ross do try to get it on, but he starts to Hulk out.
Yeah, because they've based his transformation on like pulse rate rather than whether or not he's angry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if they're going to stay true to that, the relationship with Black Widow, should it go the next step, is incredible.
It just can't go to that step. It obviously needs to have lots of hugs, soothing yeah. music, scented candles.
Yeah. And
romantic walks.
Tantric sex.
Yeah. Something tantric, something, you know, just go, keep it cool. You know.
And it doesn't matter, you know, we'll buy him a cheap laptop, we'll buy him a Skype camera, and if he hulks out and smashes everything to shit when he's having an orgasm, it's okay. But, I mean, that's the thing. There are people that overcome various kinds of disability in that realm. And
actually, I want to know, how did you find the scene? Because a lot of people on the internet went into a bit of a Hulk rage themselves over the scene. It's about halfway through the movie. They've all kind of retreated to lick their wounds at Hawkeye's house. And there's a scene between Black Widow and Banner in one of the bedrooms where she talks about not being able to have children and that she's a monster. And there's a lot of people who read that as...
I think she's saying two separate things there. I mean, really, I don't think the character, you know, the character Natasha is stupid enough to buy that shit.
Because my feeling was it's actually just the problem is it's slightly clumsy dialogue. I can see what Whedon was trying to write, but he hasn't quite phrased it.
What he's saying is, I can't have children and I'm a monster. There's a conjunction there that's missing somehow.
Yeah.
And I can understand that. I mean, you know, she's been an assassin. She has killed people who didn't necessarily deserve it. And that weighs heavily on her as a person. And she's now taken a career choice and moved to a direction of trying to balance that book. And she even is comfortable enough with that to use it to trick Loki.
Mm.
She actually used something which Loki thought was her bearing her soul, but is her saying the path that her life is going on and the path she's chosen as a way of psyching him out. So she's comfortable enough to use something personal as a part of what she's trying to do. And you don't do that if you're still really raw about it. If you're sure of what you're doing, you can use that. If you're not sure of what you're doing, you would have...
Because there's the scene in the first one, isn't it?
Yeah, in the first one.
Because I love that scene. And that's another one that got a lot of controversy.
I love Mewling Quim as a concept.
The reason I can understand why people are offended, because once you understand what he's saying by Mewling Quim, you know, it is deeply offensive. But the reason I never had a problem with it in that scene is that, one, because they're using a different word, it's not as overtly offensive as if he'd said it in colloquial current language.
Yeah, see you next, Charlie.
But
Tuesday,
but the other thing is that scene, it's like kind of as you just explained, in that scene, there's not a point in that scene where she doesn't have all of the agency.
Yeah,
absolutely. So while it might be a scene where someone's saying something very derogatory to a woman, the woman is the character in that scene which has all of the power, and that's what made it a really strong scene for me.
But this also brings up another issue about online dialogue, which really pisses me off. People assume that because they like an actor and they like a character, that character has to act according to their moral compass.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're playing a total psychopath and a nutcase, yes, you are going to say things that are transgressive, and you may be racist, and you may be sexist, and you may be really damaging to another human being, because that's the character. It doesn't mean that the filmmakers are on board with that as a personal concept.
Yeah.
It means that what they're showing is that this person is a prick.
Yeah.
And too many people online now are arguing points that aren't valid from that viewpoint, which is, it's a character. It's not the studio, it's not the actor, it's not the director, it's not the writer who believe that. It's the character that believes that.
Yeah, there's a nuance involved. You can have a film that has, for example, a sexist character, but it may not be a sexist film.
Yeah.
By the other grounds, you could have a film where none of the characters are actually intended to be sexist, but the film itself, whether it's script or direction.
Yeah.
Michael Bay is a classic example where he shoots women in his films.
What women want is Mel Gibson. Where that one is monstrously horrible.
Have you seen the remake?
Is it a remake?
They remade it in Hong Kong, starring Andy Lau.
No.
Which is
just, still just as bad?
It's just as bad.
Okay.
But only just in Cantonese. But
it's not only bad, it's bad in Cantonese. But, Age of Ultron, I didn't like it as much as I wanted to. I think that because they were doing their balancing act, because so much was cut out to make it fit the time.
Yeah, there'll be no talk of something like an hour or more footage cut out.
Yeah, I'm kind of dithering on the idea that maybe they should have made it into two films. And that's it. That again raises its own problems. But or just gone Lawrence of Arabia and chucked an intermission in the middle. Which is totally against model of cinemas these days, but it may well have been a valid thing there. They weren't going to lose money on it because the merch would have covered it all.
Yeah, it was. This movie was guaranteed to make money.
Yeah.
But I suppose it has a... The thing to acknowledge going in, I suppose, is that it had a very, very hard thing to do. They've got six protagonists, and then they have to add another two with Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch. And then they've got one main villain in Ultron. In the first act, they've got another villain. They've got, it was a Baron von Strucker or Strucker.
Yeah, he's just there so they can get the stuff.
You know, they've got the Ulysses Claw comes in for a sequence in the second act.
Yeah.
So they've got an awful lot of characters. And even when you get to the climax, suddenly you've also got War Machine has a small part in it, and you get little cameos from people like Falcon. And so there's a lot of characters they're juggling. And a lot of requirements to have the scenes with Thor that lead into Thor Ragnarok and have the scenes relating to Wakanda to introduce Black Panther. So on the Vision's the other one as well. I knew there was another character. They introduced the Vision as well. So there's a huge pile of requirements to squeeze into what's about a 2-hour, 20-minute movie.
Yeah.
And even that said, though, I don't think the script that Joss Whedon wrote to fill that in was perhaps, A, the best script that could have been written and also the best script he was capable of.
And the other thing, too, is the whole Hulkbuster sequence...
Yeah.
It's almost superfluous to the plot of the film.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. And I love I love Veronica and I love the Hulkbuster armor. And I love them kind of whacking against each other. But from the plot point of view, it could have been that, you know, he went mad and tore up a forest or something like that. It would have had
the same. Do you know why the Hulkbuster satellite's called Veronica?
Veronica Mars?
No, because Bruce Banner's number one greatest love is Betty.
Oh, okay.
And so they've called the Iron Man's one Veronica.
I thought it was like a Veronica, like that move that bullfighters do, where you kind of wear the bull out. But yeah, it's that thing was, even though it is a masterpiece of special effects, you can't argue that it's not.
Yeah.
It really is superfluous to the plot in a lot of ways. There are other ways to get Banner to the point he is at the end of the film. But they wanted something big, they wanted something merchable.
Oh, yeah.
I just invented the word merchable.
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 That's a terrible word.
It is.
I'm probably the one person who asked.
It took me a second to think it up. Yeah.
I'm a complete sucker for The Incredible Hulk. And I have a problem that in his two live-action films, then The Avengers, and now in Age of Ultron, I am incapable, no matter how many times I've seen it, the moment Banner transforms into the Hulk and starts throwing tanks or smashing buildings, I start giggling uncontrollably like a six-year-old. It's like a physiological reaction. I can't stop laughing the moment the Hulk starts trashing stuff. So I could quite happily watch 2 hours of
the
Hulk throwing tanks.
The Ang Lee Hulk has some really good stuff in it, and I like the bits that nobody else likes in that movie. There's the bit where he's fighting the helicopters in the desert.
Yeah.
And you get you get the physicality of the Hulk more than you have in any other movie.
I'm a really big fan of the Ang Lee Hulk. I don't think it's a perfect film, but I think it's a much more interesting film.
And I love the bit where he grabs one of the Sidewinder missiles, bites the top off it, and spits it at the helicopter. I mean, that's audacious to do that. It could have been played as silly. But instead, it's like, fuck.
And also, he's fighting three hulked out poodles.
With a straight face. I like the Hulk dog. Nobody likes the Hulk dog.
I love the Hulk dogs because it's so stupid.
That's why we're doing a podcast together. But the Hulk dogs are great. And, you know, I want to see what happened to the Hulk dogs.
Could have had their own spin-off.
Yeah.
Apparently that movie is
They became sad and angry and rabid puppies.
That's the rage of puppies.
Yeah.
The reason we're not getting a Hulk movie is apparently because Universal, because of that film, still has a stake in Hulk films. So
that's a shame.
Marvel Studios want to make a Mark Ruffalo Hulk movie. They have to co-produce it with Universal, and Universal gets half the
Ruffalo,
money.
I think Ruffalo's a great guy to play the Hulk. I think his Banner in Hulk, he's got what it needs. He plays the dialogue that Whedon gives him fantastically well.
I liked him a lot more in this than I liked in the original Avengers. In the original Avengers, I found him a little bit too laconic. And I got, as a Hulk nerd from the comics, I got really irritated at his justification in the climax that, I am always angry. It's like, no, you're not. That's not the point of the character.
Yeah,
but I liked him a lot more in the second one, though.
I liked the bit where, you know, he put the gun in his mouth and the other guy spat out the bullet.
Yeah.
It's a great bit of dialogue, and I think that Ruffalo delivered that fantastically well. It's got that kind of pain and anguish in it without overstating it. I like Ruffalo as an actor, and I like him as a person, too, because he's said some things that are kind of wise about female agency in movies and things like that.
Yeah, he seems an odd actor to be in such high profile, in such a high profile franchise. He's very much that actor, like almost like a Philip Seymour Hoffman level, where he's an amazing actor who's really strong in every role he has. But you feel he's the kind of actor who should be sticking to things like The Kids Are All Right, or other kind of In the Cut, these kind of smaller independent films.
But I like the fact that they're not getting just the over the top big guys in. I like the fact that they're getting some decent characters. I like the Tilda Swinton thing.
Yeah.
Getting some interesting character actors in there. makes the whole pudding richer.
Yeah.
And I like Ruffalo in that as well. I mean, this year we've got Ant-Man coming up with Paul Rudd, which is an interesting choice there because it's going to be played a bit lighter.
Paul Rudd's really overdue to be a major movie star. I've been a huge fan of his comedy
skills. Yeah, I like Paul Rudd's stuff. He hasn't done anything badly.
Yeah. He's not always been in the best things, but when he's in them, he's good.
Even in the Anchorman movies, Paul Rudd's fun.
Yeah.
And Ant-Man's an interesting one too because, the shrinking down to microscopic size and the controlling insects thing takes that bombastic over-the-top element of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and reverses it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool too. I really... Everyone's falling asleep.
Don't say it out loud. There's people listening to this podcast who don't know that there is anybody asleep. And now you just...
I'm going to get a paper bag, blow it up and go bang next time this happens. No two ways about it. John's not. John, appreciate that, mate.
Also charging your phone.
Okay, no problem. Thanks for telling me that because you just totally destroyed my ego.
Absolutely. That's what I'm here for.
Nice to... Thank you for sitting in anyway, mate. But, yeah...
I am enjoying the discussion, mate.
I appreciate that.
Actually, one question about...
You come down into the front and ask and we'll get on the mics. Or I don't mind you doing that. We're breaking the fourth wall for you, okay?
One question about the Tilda Swinton thing in Doctor Strange, and yes, she's an amazing actress and will do well. I've been reading a lot of commentary that indicates that the role, it's effectively a whitewashing of the original
of character. An Asian character.
Yeah.
Depends on how they play it. It can possibly be considered a whitewashing of an Asian character, just in case your question didn't get brought up by the mic. I want to see how they play it before I make a judgment call. Because if they do the Shangri-La kind of temple thing, that's one thing. If they relocate that to somewhere else for whatever reason and the character's not written through that text as a character, an Asian character. We've got to 5 o'clock.
Yeah, and you've got actually it's 10 minutes to the hour.
You got this panel?
This is a 2-hour panel.
Oh, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right.
I just thought, geez, time flies when you're having fun, but thanks anyway. No, I'll edit this out, it's okay, but thanks anyway. We love your work.
It's a lot of human interest if you leave it in.
The fuck? Okay. Okay, well, so I'm going to break the fourth wall again. What are you knitting, Elaine?
Crocheting. This is going to be a blanket for the local cat haven. They basically having a knitting for kitties, but I'm doing crochet, and it's basically going to go to a cat that's going to go out.
So your charity's up cats and podcasters.
No, that's just what I crochet.
If we could ever get a cat, if I get my cat to do a podcast, it won't be the most interesting podcast.
Yeah.
Given the majority of cats' communication is visual rather than auditory, but you know.
Basically, it's because Granny Squares are the easiest thing to do and take the least brain power. Okay, otherwise, cool. I would be crocheting mini Cthulhus.
Oh, that works too. But so cat podcast, we can talk about that. I would like my cat to do a podcast. The only way to get Jill to do a podcast was if we didn't feed her or let her out. Because then we would have
it'd be like an hour of wailing that you could download as an MP3.
My cat talks. It's really weird because they mimic human voices. So when I open the door and go, hello, she goes, hello.
Yeah, we used to have a cat
in the same tone, the same two tones, hello. She'll do that. So basically what I want for my iPhone is a cat translator, which would be really cool because I like hold it up to the cat and go, feed me, you absolute prick. Okay, I'll know what the cat means now.
Is that pretty much all the cat says? Hungry, hungry.
Or we could just do an app. We could just do an app which pretends to translate cats and says things like that.
I actually thought, it's one of those really dumb things on the internet that there's someone's gotten their dog and attached a digital camera around the dog's neck facing forward and then wired it up to a heart monitor on the dog's neck.
Yeah.
So every time the dog's heart rate suddenly jumps up because it's suddenly gotten excited by something. Mm. It takes like a few photos.
So what are you going to see?
And then they put this gallery together on the internet of all the stuff that made this guy's dog excited.
Yeah, most of it is the back of a female dog's head. But,
but it's like there's a cat. It keeps meeting like the household cat. And every time it sees the cat, it's like, oh, the cat's under the chair. So there's always photos of a cat looking like really tense and angry. There's a photo of a bunch of pigeons looking startled.
Yeah.
There's lots of photos of food.
Okay.
The one that's actually really, really sweet is that they came home and the dog's other owner had arrived home while they were out on their walk.
Yeah.
And so there's a photo of the thongs, or the flip-flops, for international listeners, of the you know, the other person living in that house. So it sees that their shoes, sees their home, and its heart rate has increased because it's so excited. Because, oh, yeah, such and such is home, and it's taken a photo. It's really
dogs are such sycophantic little fuckers, aren't they?
Yeah, that's why I have cats.
Yeah.
If I have a pet, I want it to, like, you know, have the courage to hate me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like pets that look like they belong in French cafes. And cats are there. Dogs are like, oh, geez, you know, dogs are like Stockholm Syndrome pets. they're your slave because you've been looking after them for so long. But cats, you know, yeah, you left me in the house, I don't give a fuck. I mean, I like that attitude. I like the fact that cats just don't get hair. And they snuggle up to you when they want to, but they're not needy.
I feel like we've suffered really badly from mission creep from Age of Ultron.
Yeah, I don't care. It's my podcast. I can talk what I like. But, yeah, Marvel Cinematic Universe. So we're going to be getting Black Panther, which will be interesting, particularly if they get an African or an African-American director. I think that's going to be a big step.
Yeah, they have been talking. I've forgotten her name. It's the woman who directed Selma, film that got a whole pile of Oscar nominations.
Yeah, I hope it's not just a tokenism thing. And my only concern with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I think they'll find their feet again. I think that they've got enough smart people on board that they'll do some missteps, but they won't totally fall off the cliff. But my big concern is studio interference. Not Marvel, but Disney, who sits on their shoulders.
Mm.
I think that's the problem. They're a monolithic, old-school company.
Disney's... Because one of my many, many sort of, you know, interests is Disney. I like Disney's animated films. Mm. I find Disney really fascinating.
We argue about that, don't we?
Yeah. It's one of my things I like. Other people are perfectly welcome to hate them.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of reasons why you might. But one of the things that interests me is the way Disney, in the last 10 years... also has worked at a corporate level where Disney's driven by merchandise.
Yeah.
Like, if you actually look at the company as a whole, their feature film division does not generate anywhere close to even, you know, a third of the money that the company makes. It's all in merchandise and theme parks.
Yeah.
And the only reason they keep making movies and TV shows is because that basically generates IP for them to then exploit in merchandise and theme parks.
Yeah.
One of the things they worked out was that they had, in terms of toys, they had the girls' market absolutely cornered.
Yeah.
You know, with Tinkerbell and the Fairies, Disney Princess, all that kind of stuff. And when it came to selling toys to boys, basically about 10 years ago, the point where Cars, the Pixar movie, was generating them about $1 billion a year in merchandise, which is why we got a Cars 2, even though Cars was not the most interesting of Pixar's films.
No.
It's why we got Planes. It's why we're getting a Cars 3.
There's a rescue thing.
Yeah, yeah, Planes, Fire and Rescue.
Yeah.
So they had that, but they didn't have anything else. And every time they tried launching a franchise for boys, you know, and there's a whole pile of them, that, like, you know, Around the World in 80 Days with Jackie Chan and Steve Coogan. They tried Prince of Persia. They tried the last one before, you know, which they kind of let tank and burn, was John Carter. That was like 2012.
John, there's a great book about John Carter that's for sale really cheaply on the Kindle store.
Oh, I think I've read that.
Yeah.
The one about them making the film.
And... yeah, about them making the film and about how the studio interfered and screwed it up. And the fact that they'd used a 100-year-old book, which every second movie, including a lot of Spielberg and Lucas,
have ripped off. That's just strip-mined.
Yeah, they strip-mined John Carter and strip-mined Edgar Rice Burroughs without any attribution. And the movie is a standalone I like. I think it's got a lot of audacity to it. It's got a unique look. It's got some kick-ass monsters.
It's got a beautiful score by Michael Giacchino as well.
Yeah. Did you hear about Morricone? He said the modern scores are shit.
Yeah, I know. That sounded like classic grumpy old man shouting at clouds.
Yeah, but it's Ennio Morricone, so I'm going to at least listen to his opinion.
Yeah, I was just like, you're an old man shouting. It's like every time Alan Moore complains about something now in comics, I'm just like, yeah, you're a grumpy old man.
Yeah, but he's entitled.
People keep stealing my ideas and reworking them in new forms, and that's not creative, says the man who wrote League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yep, which they're doing again.
Yeah, I heard that.
Be interesting to see what they do. Anyway, we're going to get back to something else because we're going to drop Age of Ultron for a moment because this is important.
Yeah.
Grant is one of the Patreon subscribers to the podcast, so he gives me pocket change every month, and therefore he went into the drawer to get the box of wonderfulness that I give out on my birthday every year. This is the first time I've done it, but I've already got the second box going. So, Grant, I'm going to give you the box, and here's what I want you to do with it.
Okay.
I want you to keep everything you want.
Yep.
And anything you don't want in the box, offer to audience members.
Oh, okay.
If you're okay to do that.
Yeah.
There's the box with my love for your support, mate.
I was going to say earlier, when we started talking about Patreon, the thing I love, just want to try to open this box, the thing I love about Patreon is that for me, as, say, a supporter, it's maybe a little as a dollar a month, $2 a month, $5, whatever I want to give. So it's not a lot of money to me, and it's PayPal, so it just comes out of my bank account. But, of course, if 100 people are giving, $1 a month, and that means the person who's creating the art that's going out on the web for free, you're getting $100, or $200 or $300, whatever it goes. So it's just it's a beautiful kind of cultural.
Oh, it very thing. Much is, and one of the things too is that I'm getting my just on my tranche yesterday of monthly Patreon money, and Jetta, the classic Australian film, is coming out on Blu-ray. My Patreon money is going to go on that, and then I will do it on the podcast. And I like that because that way I get money from the audience, I get something good, I give back to the audience with that. So there's a circularity to it that I like doing. And I will be getting Jetta. Umbrella Entertainment, I've got to give a shout out to Umbrella Entertainment as well, because those guys are getting digitally remastering a lot of Australian films that there's only shonky copies of and releasing them on new media.
Yeah,
they're doing Jetta, which was in fairly shonky condition. They worked with the Australian Film and Sound Archive to do that. They're doing Goodbye Paradise, a 1980s Australian film I love, with Ray Barrett.
Yep.
It's about an attempted coup d'etat in southern Queensland. And they're doing other things like that. So
they also did, I remember a couple of years ago, they did two Fred Skepsi films, Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith and Devil's Back... Not Devil's Backbone, that's... Devil's Playground.
So these are good people and they're doing good stuff. But anyway, opening in the box, first thing...
It's like one of those unboxing videos where
It's like one of the unboxing videos.
Ooh. It's a framed print. Is it a print or a
picture? It's a print.
It's a print of Pinhead from... Oh, I like that.
Okay, well, you can keep the framed Pinhead print.
That's really cute. For anyone who hasn't seen Hellraiser, the first one, absolutely awesome. Hellraiser 2 through however many they made, like 19 or something.
Yep.
It's Overlook Hotel coasters, which I'm also going to keep because my wife is a huge fan of The Shining. It's got the carpet pattern
from the Overlook Hotel from The Shining.
That's actually really cool.
Yep, so we've got that going.
Nerd Play Series 1, 10 exclusive cosplay trading cards.
Yep. You're keeping the cosplay trading cards?
That's going to sound really, really creepy. I'm sure someone in the audience must want 10 exclusive cosplay trading cards. James is looking awkward. I'm going to throw them to James, one of our audience members, who's now staring awkwardly as they're landing.
While you're doing that, who wants a copy of Wake in Fright? It's a classic Australian film.
But don't all leap up at once. It's an amazing... If anyone hasn't seen it, it actually is it kicks like an amazing...
Jane, come on, Jane. Jane Radley. Famous writer of very erotic stuff at times.
Paul Morrissey's Blood for Dracula on Blu-ray. This is a really good box.
It is a good box.
I was honestly expecting something less, which is not a comment on you, just a comment on what I would have
done. What I do is I fish around, and when I see good things cheap, I'll add them to the box.
Udo Kier is always good. I actually don't have a copy of this. So there you go. This is getting very me-centric.
That's okay.
That's good. You won. You get cheap.
Russell Crowe's Noah. I already have Russell Crowe's Noah. Well, it's actually Darren Aronofsky's Noah.
Who wants it? It's got interesting moments in it.
Just a quick review. I was very hesitant to see this film because I'm a big fan of Darren Aronofsky, like Black Swan and Pi and Requiem for a Dream. And then he announced he was doing the Book of Genesis as a movie. And I was like, that's... The story of Noah is like 8 sentences long. And it's amazing because it's basically a post-apocalyptic science fiction film that just happens to be heavily based...
Yeah, on the Bible.
And it's got an amazing sequence when they're all on the ark and... Noah, played by Russell Crowe, which is probably one of the best things he's done in many a year.
Yeah.
It's a very strong performance. He's telling the story of creation, so you're hearing the words of the Bible, except the visuals, once he starts telling him, is basically showing you the evolution of the universe and all species. So it's simultaneously doing the scientific explanation. It's really good if anyone hasn't seen it. Have you seen it? I'm looking. Go on, have a copy.
Okay. Any horror...
Pass it forward if you don't.
Anybody a horror fan? You a horror fan? Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
One of the people shaking their head, because I did a panel at this convention last night on horror movie showing clips, and one of the two just walked in and said, "This is why I don't like horror movies," and walked out.
Yeah.
And the other one just kind of hid between his hands. For... I have a Blu-ray, which I also already have, of Stanley Kubrick's The Killing.
See, this is why people should subscribe.
And also as a bonus includes Killer's Kiss. You get two Stanley Kubrick movies.
You do.
In one set. That's fantastic.
Yep.
Anyone? You can just see.
Give it away.
Yeah, go on.
Do me a favour, because I'm giving it to him, giving it to you. Give it away to someone that would really appreciate it. I don't mind passing things on, as long as they go eventually to someone that would really appreciate it.
I've got a Blu-ray of the Hammer film Frankenstein Created Woman, which I don't have, so I'm keeping that.
Yep.
We've got a Funko Pop Werewolf.
Yep.
Anybody? Would you like a Funko Pop Werewolf?
Someone's just
walked into the room, and now they're looking with slight confusion because they've only come in to retrieve their water bottle. We're doing prize giveaway to our enormous audience of people.
There you go. I am temporary audience. Yeah, werewolves. My favourite.
There you go.
also being recorded.
Yep.
Hi.
Yep.
This is huge. H.G. Wells is the Time Machine, George Powell production. Anybody? Because I've already got that as well. 50s movie, John.
The we'll give it out to somebody else later.
We'll give it to someone. There's actually a fan auction tomorrow.
Yeah.
Stand By Me on DVD. Fantastic Rob Reiner film, starring Will Wheaton.
Oh, you
if you honestly, you're squinting at it, Elaine. If you honestly haven't seen it, it's one of the best movies ever.
How about Ghostbusters 1 and 2? There you go.
Jacob's Ladder, actually don't have a copy of that.
Keep okay, cool.
Very good film.
See, this is all the stuff you get if you're a Patreon subscriber.
The weirdest thing ever, given how much I know you love Star Wars, Terry, and episode...
Why do you think you're getting it? It's a Star Wars
It's a little cell from... Oh, it's the incest moment.
It's incest.
It's Leia, Leia kissing Luke in the medical bay at the start of Empire.
It's actually a film cell.
Yeah, it's a little film cell framed. The scene that will haunt the two of them for the rest of their lives.
It is.
That is like seriously. Why did no one? I mean, I am a big fan of Star Wars because I'm the right age. I know you're not. But why
I can explain this?
Why did no one in the production process of Return of the Jedi, when George Lucas said, "You know what? I think I'm going to make them brother and sister," why did no one say, "Hey, George, remember 3 years ago when you had them snog?"
No, basically, there's a couple of reasons. A, George Lucas only was going to make one movie, regardless of the retro history. There, he was only going to make one movie.
Yeah.
So he had them snogging, wanted to do like a love triangle and stuff like that. The thing goes virally popular, decides he's going to make sequels, and then he decides just to ignore that scene.
Because the plan for Return of the Jedi was that there was going to be Luke's sister was going to get introduced as another female character, like sort of an evil Darth Vader sort of apprentice or whatever. But then they decided that would probably lead into another film, and so they just sort of tailed off. It's just,
but all that stuff about it being episode 4 is like retro. What's it, retcon?
Yeah, because when it came out in cinemas in the first time, there was no episode 4 A New Hope. It was just Star Wars.
Yeah, it was just
the original in 77 release,
Absolutely.
And then 78, when they re-released it, it says episode 4 A New Hope, when they knew they were going to be making a sequel.
Yeah, but originally it was only one movie. The Star Wars. And you got a frame from Nightmare on Elm Street as
Which is a fabulous movie.
There you go.
The original is such a strong
film. Whatever happened to Johnny Depp? Yeah.
That's young, nice young Johnny Depp who gets brutally murdered.
Yeah.
Gunfight at the OK Corral, I don't have.
That's a classic.
Annie Hall, I do have. Does anybody want to see Annie Hall? I have a friend.
Even though it is a Woody Allen movie.
Woody Allen.
Yeah.
It's weird. I'm a huge, huge fan of Woody Allen.
It's
and
not like
I'm
there's
also...
not a planet full of people. Marrying relatives is probably not a good thing.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to get into this on the podcast.
You can get into
it. I used to be a huge fan of Woody Allen, and I have a whole pile of his films, and I'm also a big fan of, like, Innocent Until Proven Guilty. So there was allegations came out that he sexually molested his daughter.
Yeah.
Which all seemed very sort of up in the air, and it had been investigated by the police, and the police had found no grounds for prosecution.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, if you look at the statistics and the odds that his daughter would be lying about it are astonishingly low, so therefore... But at the same time, as a person, I've always got this idealistic idea of... You know, innocent until proven guilty and blah, blah, blah. But I can't deny the fact that since those allegations came out, I haven't seen a single Woody Allen film.
Yeah.
Because every time I see a new one on the DVD shelf or out in the cinema, I think, oh, I might really like that. And then there's just that really awful, awkward hesitation. Yeah. I don't know how to emotionally
respond. I did like Midnight in Paris. I did see
Midnight. I haven't seen it.
I like it as a movie. I like it as a time travel movie as well.
Yeah.
But, again... That's the problem. There are movies that you can't appreciate because of that. We had this discussion on social media about how comfortable I was doing Chinatown.
Yeah, because I was interested in that as well.
Because Polanski, of course, raped a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, and that one's not even in question. He actually got prosecuted.
He got prosecuted
and
for raping
the country before
girl.
He was sentenced.
And my argument was that the man who made Chinatown hadn't committed that crime yet. The stuff afterwards I won't touch.
Yeah.
But Chinatown I find an iconic film and it's got a lot of important things to say. And I like the sequel as well. So I can... Yeah, I may be splitting hairs, but I can go to that point.
Yeah, well, I think
it's... not beyond it.
And also the thing is, I mean, you know, Roman Polanski's director, he's not the only person who made Chinatown. So do you boycott 399 people because of one person?
Yeah.
It's such a really hard... I don't know. I don't have any kind of... judgment on how people respond to when you get these kind of problematic filmmakers or if you suddenly get a filmmaker who says incredibly racist things, for example, or sexist things, or I think everyone has to find a way to negotiate those issues though.
Yeah, and that's the thing, the more we know, the harder it is to find people that aren't offensive.
I feel bad because I
want to
invest in stuff instead.
Go to the Star Wars thing, but thanks for staying as long as you did.
Yeah, well, it's a
chore. Cool.
Did you want a Batman?
Of course I did.
Stay there.
That's actually
no,
very
joking,
cool.
I'm joking.
That's a very cool Batman.
It is. That's the 1960s Batman.
This is the hugest box. I honestly think if anybody wants to have the nicest, most funnest box ever, you absolutely have to support Terry's Patreon campaign.
It's a lot of swag.
It's an Adventure Time Happy Meal toy.
Jake the dog.
Jake the dog. Has something to do with him. Oh, it's a manga of Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Yep.
Which again, I'm going to keep because my wife loves Evangelion.
There you go.
This is like my wife's birthday.
By the way, to this podcast. Is it her birthday?
It is in July, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because Sonia was supposed to come on, but she had somebody else.
Yes, she had an audition for a play.
She gets a rain check because anybody who has to drop out gets a rain check.
Saul Goodman. Yeah, Better Call Saul. Have you seen Better Call Saul yet?
No.
I've seen bits of Breaking Bad.
I've got too much to watch.
Yeah, that's my problem. Yeah. I'm so far behind on my stuff. Calvary, which I've heard many, many good things about.
Brendan Gleeson, great movie, if you're on.
That's from John Michael McDonough.
This is why people should support.
I'm going to watch that. Probably review it in my blog.
Yep.
Gets back to that playing it forward. Planet of the Vampires, which again, I've never actually
seen. It's an American one, so you've got to have a multi-zone.
Yeah, I've got a multi-zone. DVD. Mario Bava.
Cool. Here we go, more audience. We have double the audience numbers. This is fantastic.
This is just going on and on.
It is.
Star Wars Boba Fett fan wraps.
Yep. I don't know what fan wraps are. I think there's something to do with food.
They're designed for automotive use.
So basically, you stick pictures of Boba Fett on your car.
I don't think I'm going to get away with
this.
Which
is an incredibly funny thing to do. It's an amazing.
But I've got a very good friend who's one of the world's largest fans of Boba Fett. So
I know who you mean.
Yeah. Which is really interesting because he's not the most nuanced character in the universe, is he?
No. I was talking to someone about this, again, on social media, I think yesterday. Because there's rumours that one of Disney's Star Wars movies, like they're doing like sort of spin-off films outside their original episodes, they're going to do the Boba Fett movie. And it's a really odd idea, because if you actually go back and look at Boba Fett in the films, he's just a guy who stands there.
It's just like 600 different Temuera Morrisons. And they get an actor, a Maori actor, Temuera Morrison, to play Boba Fett, and do nothing with this incredibly charismatic and gifted actor. It's like getting... Yeah. We'll go back a little bit. It's like getting Charles Laughton to stand there holding a lamp.
It is a bit.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
Isn't he then cloned into all of the Imperial Stormtroopers?
He was.
He's all the clone troopers, yeah.
But all of the clone troopers should be standing there trading jibes in Maori English.
Now, what they should be doing is a haka.
Yes.
Because it would have been really interesting if all of the Boba Fetts did a haka.
We're all going, hey, bro.
Tomate.
Because I've also got Star Wars Issue 1, the new Marvel comic, which I actually haven't read yet, so that's kind of cool as well. And I didn't mention the copy of The Vampire Lovers on Blu-ray. I hope people are keeping count, because I've got this enormous pile of swag in front of me just for supporting the podcast.
Yeah.
And Monster High figures.
The Star Wars Issue 1 was actually quite disappointing, because they're not being very adventurous.
You got a copy of The Time Machine?
Yes.
There you go. I just gave away the time machine.
It's all very...
George Pell.
The new Marvel Star Wars comics are all very, very tightly controlled by Lucasfilm in a way that they weren't when they were under Dark Horse.
It ends up being a bit boring as a result, because they're not adding anything to the canon at all.
Yeah. I think the problem they've got with a comic spin-off like that is they're setting it between two Star Wars movies, so you know what's going to happen to all the characters, and you know who's going to live and die, so who really cares what happens in the middle.
Yeah, that's the problem with doing that interstitial stuff, unless you take it in a totally different direction with different characters.
Yeah.
There's a certain expectation and a certain lack of surprise.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and again, it's a cash cow for a studio.
That's actually what I was... Yeah, I'd never actually finished saying ages ago in this conversation.
Well,
about
we can come back to a previous...
The way that Disney operates, basically, they worked out, they didn't have any franchises for boys' toys. So all they basically did to fix that, rather than just develop their own IP, is they went out with a massive checkbook and bought Lucasfilm and Marvel.
Yeah.
And now they've suddenly got them. Yeah. And while that's good for them on a corporate level, because they've now cornered the boys' market and how, like they just...
Yeah.
You know. It's very unlikely you're going to see many original science fiction films, for example, out of Marvel anytime, not Marvel, sorry, Disney anytime in the future. They had Tomorrowland, which has underperformed.
The interesting ones are coming out on the indie side of things.
Yeah, well, that's often the case, though.
Yeah. That's a rule. With movies, as with anything else, innovation comes from the edges, it never comes from the centre. So it's little weird guys making movies like Primer and all those really quirky science fiction movies that bring interesting stuff, but then eventually some of that filters into the centre.
Yeah.
Conceptually, if not specifically.
Although get away with doing one really good movie with a decent budget.
Yeah.
With all those ideas, and then after that, they'll just be part of the machine.
Yeah, after that, it's cookie cutter filmmaking, and that's the problem.
That's what worries me with the all these Star Wars spin-off movies they're making, because, of course, they've now... There's a generation of filmmakers who are all about my age who grew up with Star Wars, and so you know, because we might not necessarily have grown up knowing the influence of Star Wars to know how much of a pastiche it is. We've got this massive, overwhelming love for the characters and the setting. And so they can go to these directors who would otherwise be doing really, really interesting films. Like Rian Johnson or Josh Trank, although I don't think he's doing one anymore. Or who's the guy who's doing... Oh, Gareth... The guy who did Monsters and the Godzilla remake. Gareth Edwards.
Powell, is it?
Gareth
Edwards, yeah.
They're getting them, and they're now doing Star Wars movies because they love Star Wars and they want to play in that sandpit. And I'm sure they're going to make, for me, you know, probably pretty entertaining movies, being a Star Wars fan myself. But I do worry about the movies they might otherwise have made that we'll now never see.
But, you know, I mean, again, because I'm a little older than you.
Yeah.
I don't find the characters that interesting in Star Wars. They're really, you know, I mean, Luke Skywalker's a whiny farm boy. Han Solo is a second-rate gunslinger.
Yeah.
They got a walking carpet there, and they've got an old fart who tells lies. I mean, you know, the characters aren't that interesting. And the worlds, I mean, the world building in Star Wars pisses me off for a lot because you have a desert planet, then a swamp planet, then a cold.
It's deliberately doing the Flash Gordon thing.
Yeah.
Except in Flash Gordon, it's all on the one planet.
The thing that was great about the first three was the backstory, because you had hints of backstory which really supported the films, like Clone Wars. Ooh, what's the Clone Wars? But when they actually did the backstory,
it was boring.
It was boring because there was no.
Because
your
mentioning the Clone Wars was just a convenient tag. Mm. It was just something to make things look more interesting than they were. Mm. It wasn't actually something they thought, okay, what are the Clone Wars? No, we'll worry about that 20 years from now if we make money.
Yeah, that's why I don't like any prequel. Anytime I hear someone's making a prequel, I kind of zone out because creatively they don't interest me.
Yeah, and even sequels, I mean, to a certain extent, where it's an interesting filmmaker and they're making a sequel to something, my instinctive reaction is, make the next thing. I want to see something new, I want to see something different. It's like for years Vincenzo Natali was trying to do Neuromancer as a movie, and I've now seen the storyboards and the conceptual art for it. And it's different than anything I've seen.
Yeah. It's very, very sad that he's not making that anymore.
And Natalia's a good director. I've seen a number of things of his that I'm really impressed with.
Yeah, he's directing Hannibal now, I think, the TV series.
Like Jodorowsky's Dune that never happened.
Jodorowsky's
Dune. People haven't seen that documentary, it's fantastically good.
It's like actually going back to John Carter. There's an amazing, you can see it on YouTube, there's an amazing test reel on YouTube of the animated John Carter that Bob Clampett.
And Fleischer. And Fleischer Studios.
Yeah. And it's this beautiful, because they decided they wanted to make it look much more realistic. So the first thing they did was rotoscope it. So they've filmed actors and animated the top of the actors. Mm. They've got very realistic movements. But then they don't use any like clean ink lines around the characters.
Mm.
And then they'll also paint in the frames in oils.
Yep.
And so it was incredibly time consuming, which is probably one of the many reasons why they never went ahead with it. Also, the apparently I think it was MGM were trying to do it, and they threw the sort of the test reel around some cinema owners and drive-in owners, say, would you like these as shorts before our pictures? And they all basically unanimously said they wanted Tarzan instead.
Yeah,
which is the other thing that killed it.
Yeah, well,
but it's a beautiful little
because
bit of
course animation. Cinema and drive-in owners know everything. Yeah,
the thing is, had they made it, it would have had they actually made this like.
Mm.
Because originally they wanted to do it as a feature. And if they had actually made this full-length animated feature of John Carter with this really interesting art style, it would have predated Disney's Snow White. And you've got to wonder what American animation would have been like if they'd started from this like sort of semi-realistic pulp sci-fi rather than very Disney-style fairy tale.
It would have taken a totally different direction. I mean, Disney dominated the industry for way too long.
Mm.
And I still maintain, much to your hatred, that the last really creative thing Disney did was Three Caballeros. Because that thing has an imagination and a breadth of cultural viewpoint that no Disney film has had since then.
They're very much their own thing. I'm trying to... I don't know. I've got very much a blind spot for a lot of the Disney animated products.
Yeah, and that's understandable too. You drink the Kool-Aid at a young age.
Yeah, the influence is enormous though, because one of the things I've actually been watching at the moment, I'm only halfway through it, is Princess Iron Fan, which is the first Chinese animated feature. It's from like about 42 or 43.
Yeah.
So they must be making it while they're under Japanese occupation. But it's in black and white, and the print, at least on the DVD version I've been watching, the print quality is from the transfer is very low.
Mm.
But it's basically an old black and white Disney short. Like that's the animation style, except it's telling a story from Journey from the West. So you've got Monkey and Pigsy and Sandy and Tripitaka and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it basically looks like you're watching this weird, ancient, forgotten Disney film that just happens to be spoken in Mandarin Chinese.
Yeah, I love the fact that we're rediscovering this stuff. People keep finding interesting things in garages and decrepit cinemas, and we find lost prints of things, and they find extra footage for Metropolis.
I keep wondering if I should buy a new version of Metropolis, but I'm worried if I do buy the Blu-ray, then they're going to suddenly announce another version because they found another 5 minutes.
Yeah, speaking along those lines, they are doing a Kickstarter to get Orson Welles' last film, The Other Side of the Wind, edited.
I saw that.
And I've seen some footage from it, and it's very haphazard and crazy looking. But in spite of that, I want to see it done. Because even if it's not incredibly successful, even if it's not another Citizen Kane or even another Touch of Evil, I want to see where Welles was as a filmmaker at that late stage of his life.
He has just such a weird career trajectory. It's almost like he starts at the top and everything he did afterwards was just slightly less famous and slightly, until he's ending up doing P commercials and Transformers movies.
Well, it's like a modern filmmaker, right? You get a Wunderkind filmmaker who started out doing podcasts and then did television and then starts making a feature film. And his first feature film is basically taking the piss out of Rupert Murdoch. How do you reckon his career is going to go? Because that's exactly, in a 1939 context, what Orson Welles was. It was William Manor First. He even mentioned Hearst's pet name for his mistress's clitoris, Rosebud. So, you know, basically, it is like the exact equivalent of your first feature film is one totally pissing off Rupert Murdoch about Rupert Murdoch's life. And you can imagine where your career arc goes after that. Yeah, eventually you are going to be doing wine commercials.
Yeah.
Powerful people have their own rules and their own gravity still, and perhaps more than they did then.
Someone made the comment that the way you tell true genius is that they don't make one great film, they make a string of them.
Hmm.
So anyone can make one really good film. It's like a corollary with the music industry is you've got your entire life to write your first album.
Yeah.
And then you've got 9 months to write your second one.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have one good movie in them, but that's the accumulation of 20 years of ideas or whatever, and then what's the sign of true genius or the true filmmaker is they have a string.
But Welles got there. I mean, the Magnificent Ambersons, before the studio recut it, Welles was doing a documentary series in South America at the time, and the studio butchered his work. That's why I don't like Robert Wise at all. Robert Wise was a guy who recut Magnificent Ambersons and totally fucked it up, and the footage that Welles could have reconstructed it with was destroyed.
And that's the bit that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, and then he made Touch of Evil, so you got at least three works of genius by Welles.
It's funny because there's certain directors that come out and their first film blows me away, and then their second film blows me away, and then it almost becomes this incredibly tense game every time they make a movie where I'm waiting for the one that disappoints me.
Yeah,
because there's always this, you know, rapidly diminishing list of directors who I don't think have made a bad film.
Mm.
You know, off the top of my head, I mean, I really like Ang Lee. I don't actually think Ang Lee has made a bad film.
No.
I love Hulk. I actually think it's a really creative movie. It's got problems, but I'd still put it on the side of good, you know? Like, cause he,
I think the third act is problematic with his father.
Oh, yeah, that's the bit the studio forced him to put in.
Yeah, but there is a ton of good stuff I like about Ang Lee's Hulk.
And Aronofsky's like another one. I don't think Aronofsky's made a bad film. I like
the
sense of
wonder
film.
About it, the Ang Lee's Hulk. That's the thing I get is, yeah, this is an unprecedented event in human history, and it portrays it.
Also, the visual, the way he does the visuals, he's actively aping comic book storytelling style.
Yep.
So when he edits from scene to scene, often you pull out of a panel and go into another panel, and he's actually tried, and some split screen stuff.
Yeah.
And he's actually trying to replicate a comic book as a film, which no other sort of major director had done.
And the ensemble's not bad either. I mean, you've got Sam Elliott in there playing Thunderbolt Ross. He's good as that.
I think he's a much better Thunderbolt Ross than William Hurt was.
I definitely think. And William Hurt's coming back into Civil Wars, I hear.
Makes me worry they're going to introduce Red Hulk.
But he's good in it. And a few other people in there. One of the people I want to get back from The Incredible Hulk is Leonard Sampson.
Oh, yeah, because he just kind of gets dropped in.
He kind of gets dropped in there, and he's an interesting side character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe who really does need to come back into it at some stage because he turns into Doc Samson.
Actually, one of the things I noticed in... This has been like the worst review of Age of Ultron ever we've
No, but I'm going to be able to cut it. I may cut it into two podcasts. So I don't mind doing that.
One of the small details I genuinely appreciated as a comic book fan is that they have a Korean scientist working with Banner... Not Banner, Stark, at the start of the film, and then she kind of gets kidnapped and forced to work for Ultron.
Yeah.
And her name's... She's Dr. Helen Cho. Her son, Amadeus Cho, is one of my favourite characters in the Marvel comics, where he's this teen genius who's billed as the seventh smartest person in the world, which I just love the fact that he's not the smartest person, he's the seventh smartest person.
Yeah. While we're on that subject, I love the Vision in Age of Ultron.
The Vision.
We haven't really talked about the Vision.
The Vision is perfect.
The Vision is perfect. Bettany does it perfectly, and there's some processing they do on the on Bethany's either his makeup or some CGI.
Yeah.
Where the skin tone is as complex as a human's, but it's not a human's. And that really works for me. I mean, the Vision is one of the wows of the movie in that sense. There's something new. You really do get that feeling that something new is coming to the world.
Yeah.
When the Vision pops out of the box. And I like that. And the fact that he comes fully formed is an interesting thing.
It's actually funny because while I thought that the script was pretty scrappy, and like the first act for me is very, very messy. The second act meanders around a bit. The third act kind of apes a lot of the same beats as the original Avengers.
Yeah.
So script-wise, it's not fantastic. And as we were saying earlier, a lot of the elements feel like they're only in there to lead into other films. There's a whole pile of stuff that frustrated me in the movie, but that one moment when they meet the Vision and he's like, well, let's go get Ultron, just blithely picks up Thor's hammer and hands it to him.
Yeah.
After they've already established in a lengthy party scene that only the most worthy people can pick up Thor. That is such a perfect moment of cinema that it almost made every other frustration with the film worthwhile.
And it's a shortcut. It's a valid shortcut to getting him into the team.
Yeah.
There's not that, are you evil, are you another Ultron kind of thing. That moment goes right.
It's like the most economical storytelling.
It is. It's beautifully economical storytelling. And it immediately gets Thor on side.
Whereas
a lesser person than the Asgardian god would have gone, oh, fuck, somebody else can do this. But he goes, no, you're okay with me. And I love it.
A little worried when...
And Captain America.
Captain America got it to wobble. Yeah, because he was surprised by that. But by the time the Vision comes along, he's on board with it. He knows that the Vision's someone they need.
The thing I love about this latest batch of Marvel movies and TV shows is because they've been run by Marvel is I grew up collecting comics in the 80s.
Yeah.
So there was still a lot of 60s comics around, still 70s comics around, and there was a certain feel to Marvel, which the comics, I think, have started to lose. Because back then, the thing about Marvel compared to DC is DC was kind of linked to 1950s America.
Yeah.
Everything looked like it was 1950s.
It's also America. Very, very idealistic.
Whereas Marvel was, you know, gritty. It was New York.
It was more nuanced.
They lived in the real world.
Mm.
But also there was a sort of a bombastic kind of feel to it. Which I think is sort of in the TV shows and especially the movies now, but is not so much in the comics because the art style's changed.
Mm.
It's not a sort of clean line, simple sort of John Buscema kind of stuff. It's much more noodly and detailed, and the stories are often a lot more intellectual as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the writers especially. And so the comics that I love, the Marvel comics that I loved reading and I grew up reading, I find that spirit in the films and the TV shows a lot more. So I don't tend to read Marvel comics much anymore, but I really love even those little Marvel one-shots.
Yeah, it's really funny because you get those partwork magazines where you like either subscribe or go to the newsagent and every fortnight a new thing comes out, you build a chess set. There's one they've been doing called the Marvel Graphic Novels Collection where basically it's $20 Australian a fortnight, and every fortnight they mail you a hardcover book that's got a trade collection of Marvel. And when they first did it, it was very sneaky. It was going to be 60 volumes, which was like, okay, fine, $20. I can afford, I've got a job. I can afford $20 a fortnight. Yeah. It's kind of cool to get it in the mail, read a comic, because I'm very much a DC fan historically. So this was all new to me. I knew I wasn't going to be getting anything in the mail that I hadn't already bought 10 years ago. Yeah. And when they hit the 60 and people were still buying it, they very quietly extended it to 120. But because they kind of did the history of Marvel from the beginning up to at the time the present.
Yeah.
There's only so many storylines that have been published in the last 5 years that they can sort of throw into future volumes. They've basically got 20 future volumes, and there's these 40 volumes are getting delivered every fortnight of stuff from the, 60s basically, early 60s through the 70s.
Mm.
And it was really weird reading these, and there's so many bits that you read in these really old comics that they've actually now done in the movies.
Yeah.
Like there's a Captain America storyline back from the period when it was Captain America and Falcon was the name of the comic.
Yeah.
There's a storyline called Secret Empire, which is basically Captain America the Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
Like, because I know when they did the Winter Soldier as a movie, everyone assumed they were going to do the Winter Soldier storyline from the sort of the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
And it was very, very different. And I thought they just invented a new plot, but it turns out they hadn't. They just went all the way back to like the early 1970s.
Yeah, which is good because Winter Soldier was very much a 1970s conspiracy thriller.
Yeah.
It's the parallax view, it's all the president's men with action in it.
I was really impressed with that. I wasn't expecting to like it.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't a huge fan of the first Captain America movie.
And also they gave Scarlet Witch a lot of agency.
Scarlet Johansson.
Johansson,
yeah,
a lot of agency in that too. She was basically leading the old guy around. for a lot of the movie.
So do you think...
That's like, my new name for Captain America, the old guy.
The old guy?
Yeah.
And they threw in Arnim Zola as well.
No, well, they did, yeah. And they threw in a lot of old computer technology too.
The disembodied computer. Disembodied computer. Yeah. Toby Jones, isn't it? It's a great actor. Yeah. Playing.
They didn't do the Kirby version, but at least they did a version.
Yeah. Well, that's my hope for the Doctor Strange movie, is that it goes Durenko on its ass. Because that's going to be fantastic.
Oh, a touch of Ditko as well would be good.
Ditko and Starenko, yeah, absolutely.
You know, Ditko still does comics.
Yeah.
But like, he self-publishes.
He's gone right wing a bit.
I've heard. I just love the fact that he's...
Oliver Vane Ran is about as right wing as you get.
Yeah, which is really good stuff when I read it when I was like 18. But once you actually explore the universe a little more, you realise that she's just a cranky Russian lady.
who took...
Social security benefits. Yeah.
And smoked too much and screwed too many young men.
Well, it's like they did the there was a bunch of like libertarians basically made the Atlas Shrugged trilogy of films.
I've seen the first two of those.
Yeah,
and they've got a budget kind of about the same budget as this podcast.
Well, that's because by the end they were crowdsourcing the money. It didn't seem very Randian to kind of go to the masses and ask for charitable donations to make their movie.
A whole bunch of old pensioners who watch Fox News paid for it or something like that. Yeah. They're atrociously bad. And the interesting thing is, it's a trilogy of movies with the same characters in it. Different actors in each movie playing all the characters because they've had to go cheaper and cheaper actors as the three movies go. They are atrociously bad. I really should do them for the podcast with somebody who knows anything about libertarianism, but they the computer graphics in them are about 1992 level.
Oh, good lord. Okay.
And yeah, that universe where people don't want air travel because they've used up all the oil, so everyone uses really fast trains again because like that's a thing.
Yeah.
I did the movie The Fountainhead, which is based on an Ayn Rand novel.
Yeah.
For the podcast. And ripped the shit out of it because of the sexual politics of it and the fact that the nominal hero was a prick, basically.
Yeah.
And killed a couple of people because they didn't build the building the way he designed it, so he blew it up and someone got killed. Because, you know, you're allowed to do that if you design something.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
It's an atrociously bad movie.
So I suppose we're kind of out of time on the slot, but...
Yeah, well, we've still got half an hour.
Have we really?
Look at the clock.
A bit more. I thought we were finishing at the half hour mark.
No.
That was my honest belief.
No, it's cool. Okay, what are we going to do?
Hawkeye?
I loved what they did with Hawkeye.
Thank you.
Loved that they gave him...
Linda Carlin, Cardinale.
Cardellini.
Yeah, which always sounds a little bit like an Italian food. But yeah,
Scooby Doo movies, Freaks and Geeks, and ER.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of her. She doesn't appear in a lot, but when she turns up, she's always like appealing. Just what gets me is just has appeal.
Right from the moment you see her character, she's grounded.
Yeah,
And she's a. You can see why Hawkeye does what he does. The rapport between Jeremy Renner and her is really good. It plays like a good marriage, the way it should. And the actors nail it.
Yeah.
And the fact that Natasha's in there as well as a friend of the family grounds her character and gives her character a lot more depth and shows us a side of her you don't see. Because usually you see her running, jumping and hitting things. And suddenly you see why she runs and jumps and hit things. And I love that. I love the fact that they... took time for that, and they did need that breathing space because you can't run full tilt through all of a movie.
Yeah.
Well, you can, but then it becomes Mad Max Fury Road and you've got to throw in other things. But I think that worked well, and I think it's a good breathing space for the audience.
Especially because I mentioned my favourite scene in the movie was, you know, the vision with Thor's hammer.
Yeah.
But my second favourite bit of the entire movie is actually Hawkeye during the climax holed up inside a burnt out building with Scarlet Witch and gives the most ridiculously funny self-aware speech about how, yes, I know we're being attacked by giant robots and there's a god and a man in super armor and I'm just running around with a bow and arrow and this is really weird, and the fact that he actually acknowledges it's weird, but then if you can be with us and you go out and you be Avenger, this big, it's a speech that's simultaneously stirring and earnest but self-aware and ridiculous at the same time.
But he carries his weight in the team.
I really like Jeremy Renner.
Yeah,
I think he's... there's a kind of an actor... It always sounds like I'm criticising the actors, I never am. There's something in Hollywood that I kind of think of as the Colin Farrell effect.
Yeah.
Which is where there's an actor who's a often a very good actor.
Yeah.
But for some reason, the Hollywood studios, it's like they've sat around in some kind of secret collusive meeting and decided that this is going to be the next megastar.
Yeah.
Because they're still addicted to the idea of having 1980s-style megastars, even though culture has moved on, and we're probably never going to have that level of megastar again, like the Tom Cruises and the Arnold Schwarzeneggers.
We'll have one or two. You know. We won't have as many as we had in the past. Yeah.
But they pick these actors and think we're going to manufacture this actor into a star, and so they start shoving them into so many roles because they think they're going to make it, and they almost never do, because that kind of ascent to superstardom is an organic thing. You can't artificially control it as much as you want to. Yeah. So the Colin Farrell was like the obvious one for me in like sort of the late 90s and early 2000s, where he was in everything, whether he should have been in it or not.
That's from the 1930s and 40s when the studios controlled the means of production. They controlled all the theatres, so they could actually give someone a career.
Yeah, and that's actually still the case.
And a lot of second raters as well, because if they were popular with the studios and if they got a few fan letters, a lot of very ordinary actors got gigs.
That's still the case today in Japan. Japan's one of the few countries left where the film studios still own their own cinema chains. In America, they were legally forced to stop doing it.
And the thing is that then gave rise to the indie film movement in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah.
And film grew up.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that pisses me off most in all cinema is the production code. Because if you look at pre-code movies, there were nuanced movies with complexities about relationships, well-grounded, good actors doing good work. Suddenly the production code comes in with right-wing and Christian morality behind it. And everything suddenly becomes dumbed down and simplified and unrealistic. And it was only through incredible effort and incredible subtlety of writing that anything of value got through.
Yeah, it's one of those cases, I think, where there's still plenty of amazing films got produced under the code.
But it was harder to do.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, if you look just as an overall average, I think the average quality of American films definitely dropped once they introduced the code.
Well, Hollywood movies would have gone in a completely different direction if there was no code, really.
And one of the interesting things to parallel with them is, you look at the parallel between, in the 1940s and 50s, American films and French films.
Yeah.
French films were a lot grittier. There were even the smaller French films, things like there were a whole bunch of Maigret movies that Jean Gabin made.
Yeah.
And, you know, the police procedural is essentially set in Paris. But there's a grittiness and a reality to it. They're based on real crimes and real situations in there that American films at the time, even with film noir and the stylization of film noir, which the Cahiers de Cinema guys in France loved, while they weren't really appreciating the stuff that they were doing at the time, which was much, much better from the character point of view. There were women who made bad judgment calls in their love life and more the consequence of them. There were men who made bad judgment calls. But they played more realistically than the stylization of film noir.
Yeah.
And that stuff's great to rediscover. Rafifi being one of the examples, of course, where you see it played as a real criminal underworld.
Yeah.
And it's shabby and nasty, and it's got all those things that Hollywood buffed the edges off.
Yeah, I've seen very, very few French films comparatively. I know you seem to have seen a lot, or at least a lot more than me.
Is Rafifi the one where they have the scene where they're cracking the safe?
Yeah, they have 22 minutes with no dialogue.
No dialogue, which is, you'd never seen
it. And you don't need it because it's all played with gesture and movement and camera placement.
Hollywood freaks out with no dialogue. Remember they had like Pixar, who had, hadn't had a flop ever. They still haven't had a flop ever. And they were trying to release the film WALL-E, where the first 23 or 24 minutes has no dialogue in a cartoon. And they had to work for months to convince Disney to allow them to release this film.
Disney is increasingly evil.
It's very, very corporatized.
Same thing.
Disney's also primarily a distributor. And I've did a screenwriting course in Australia, which was really good because we got to talk to actual screenwriters and so forth. One of the comments that kept coming through was that you can't make a film for release in Australia unless you get the distributors to sign off on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have a completely different set of criteria, and they're very conservative, and they're product-based. So this worked last time, therefore this will work this time. So anything new, and if you don't get that sign-off, you don't get the funding.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing, too, is that 15 years ago I had some things to do with United International Production, the distribution guys.
Yeah.
There. And the people who were running that were really, really great people. You go in and to the preview screenings and they'd have Chardonnay and Bickies for you, so I love that, of course. But one of the things they did, and I had a chat with them about various things, and at that time Adam Sandler movies were really big. They were making boku bucks in Australia. and they said that they all hated Adam Sandler movies. Everybody working there threw up a little bit in their mouth watching an Adam Sandler movie. But they said, this Adam Sandler movie is going to let us release three indie films that we really want to release, and they're not going to make bucks for us. But because we've got so much black in the ledger, the parent company is going to let us do this and get this to an audience. And that were the movies they loved. That were the movies where they brought out the Chardonnay for us. Basically because they wanted to release them. They were a much better product. Eventually those films are still being shown, whereas the Adam Sandler movies you don't see anymore. But there are a whole bunch of things like Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Didn't get a distribution except for the fact that Adam Sandler movies did so well.
Well, for a while there, Adam Sandler was the most profitable actor in Hollywood.
Adam Sandler pisses me off more than, I think, any actor in Hollywood.
Is this because he did that one good film?
No.
Oh. Because that's what pisses me off about Adam Sandler.
It's for a much more basic thing. I may actually roll this podcast into a paleo cinema and talk about cinema in a wider context, but we'll see. The thing that pisses me off about Adam Sandler movies is the mean-spiritedness of the comedy.
Yeah.
There is a nastiness to the comedy, and it's mean-spirited and cruel and dumb. It's willfully unintelligent.
For me, I actually genuinely like some of Adam Sandler's films. There's a whole pile that I really can't stand, which makes it a bit of a minefield to try a new one.
Yeah.
But
two characters. There's angry Adam Sandler. And the stupid Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
So angry Adam Sandler is stuff like Happy Gilmore, Bulletproof, Wedding Singer, and the one that's fallen out of my head that's the really good one, Punch Drunk Love. I don't know if you've seen
it. Yeah, I've seen Punch Drunk Love, yeah.
Which is the one that makes me angry because he turns up in this film basically playing the same character, except it's in a slightly more realistic context, and you suddenly realise what a horrifying human being that character would actually be if you met them. And he does such genuinely good performance, and then you realise that he's making these dumb, awful movies basically on purpose because he could be doing amazing work if he wanted to. That's what makes me angry.
He's sitting on the handlebars while everyone else pedals. Yeah.
But then there's the other Adam Sandler, who's the stupid Adam Sandler of like Waterboy and Little Nicky and all these other films, which I just find gratingly annoying. So he's a very frustrating
actor. Either way, I don't find any of his movies funny.
Yeah, see, I do. But then I don't know if that's... I might have a... I'm easier to please than certain comedies.
I like some Will Ferrell movies, but I don't like others. Well, I like Step Brothers because it's that... You know, that Judd Apatow infantilized male thing.
Yeah, yeah.
This one takes it to its logical conclusion where they're like 40 years old, they're both living with their parents, the parents get married.
Yeah, I enjoyed that,
And they're both acting like teenage kids. And it's funny to see someone like Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly grooving out over Hulk hands and shit like that. I mean, there's an innate funniness to that. And the fact that when they do have to grow up in the arc of the story, they're not happy. They're not their true selves when they do that. And they eventually find careers that enable them to be the dumb fucks they are.
Yeah.
And still thrive and still function as an adult.
So it's like a subversion of the coming of age story.
Right? It is. It's a basically, you come of age, you're not happy with it, so you find a way for where you were before to work for you. And you've taken the journey, but the journey's led you back to where you were with more self-knowledge. And that's kind of cool. I like that. I like the fact that it does that. Plus, I like some of the other actors in there.
Actually, the person in comedy I'm finding really entertaining at the moment is on Paul Feig, the guy who did Bridesmaids and The Heat, which were both
Seen The Heat yet.
I was not expecting to love The Heat, and I really, really liked it.
I've got a problem with Sandra Bullock. I've got a problem with actresses, and I know this is a studio thing and it's a way men perceive women in cinema. When the Botox and the plastic surgery get to a certain point, I find them not threatening but sad.
It's... No, I know. There is certainly a point at Sandra Bullock. I noticed it in Gravity, and I noticed it in The Heat, where there is a certain inflexibility to her face. The industry is structured in such a way that a woman would feel required to do that in order to continue working.
Yeah, the weird thing
she feels it. The biggest struggle in
all of those movies is watching them try to express themselves facially.
That's a Nicole Kidman problem.
Yeah, Nicole Kidman problem, where basically it's like she's got to bench press a car to get her eyebrows to raise up.
Nicole Kidman's an interesting actor because she's pretty much the one female actor in Hollywood who can make as many financially unsuccessful films as she likes and continues to get lead roles. Every other woman in Hollywood, they get one chance.
What has she got on Tom Cruise? I think it's a blackmail thing, but that allegedly.
I'm assuming she's very good to work with, is my guess. The directors like working with her, and so they keep using her. But mass audiences no one goes to see a movie because Nicole Kidman's starring in the movie.
She manages her image very well as well because she does fashion shoots, and she sort of set herself up as a bit of a clothes horse. So
yeah,
she sort of stays in the public eye. She's got appeal. They can put her name on the poster, and
yeah,
people will still come and see her. So, and that's a career management thing. Yeah. That's a image management.
Because she, like, she can make a movie as bad as the, she did that Grace of Monaco movie, which didn't get a single good review in the entire world and financially bombed everywhere. And yet she then went off and made other films. Like, she just,
I think it may allegedly be her blackmailing Tom Cruise.
Is Tom Cruise that powerful in Hollywood, though?
Tom Cruise makes money for people.
Yeah.
I mean, short, slightly ugly guy who runs a lot.
See, Tom Cruise is another one. I actually like a lot of Tom Cruise's
films. I like the Mission Impossible movies, but I don't like Tom Cruise. I've got a cognitive dissonance there.
Mm.
And I don't like him when he takes his shirt off because he's never suntan and his chest is weird when it's shaved. It looks like, yes, they've shaved you. Are you having an operation? It's got that kind of pre-operation shape.
I've honestly never had that problem. The only thing I do have with Tom Cruise is I find him very believable when he plays complete assholes. So if he's in something like Rain Man or Magnolia or...
Well, he's channeling his true self.
Sorry? Tropic Thunder. Tropic Thunder. He's fantastic at playing slightly unlikable people who have a story arc where they learn that they're actually a bit unlikable.
Magnolia was the last
chance
for Tom Cruise to have real credibility in Hollywood as an actor rather than as a phenomenon, as a cash cow.
Yeah.
Because in Magnolia, he's fantastic. The ensemble's fantastic. He's working against the best of the best in acting.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman's in it. Everybody really good is in it. And he is fantastic in that. But after that, he drew back from that to where the money was.
I thought he's occasionally been very shortchanged. Like when Rain Man came out, I thought he was the best actor in Rain Man by a country mile. And Dustin Hoffman gave, for me, a fairly mannered performance.
Yeah, you don't go full retard.
Yeah, well, it's that kind of thing where, like, suddenly everyone paid attention to Dustin Hoffman's performance because he was playing, you know, someone with, you know, fairly severe autism. And no one really paid attention to how good Tom Cruise was.
That great story... the great story I heard about Dustin Hoffman, start of his career. He was lined up to be in a first comedy from a new director.
Yeah.
In 1968. And he also had an audition for The Graduate. So the director said to him, yep, go off there and... I know the actress in the movie is really good. Go off and try to go and get the role for The Graduate, thinking that he'd never get it.
Yeah.
So what happened was, Mel Brooks had him lined up to play the Nazi in The Producers.
Yeah.
And he was going to do an audition with Mel Brooks's wife, Anne Bancroft, for The Graduate. So Mel says to him, go and do the audition, thinking no one's going to give this short Jewish guy a go with it. He'll come back and play the Nazi for me. And sure enough, he gets the role and his career takes off, and Mel Brooks has to get Kenneth Mars to play the Nazi.
It's a beautiful piece. Hoffman's are weird. If anybody wants to hear one of the best audio commentaries on a film, there's the Barry Levinson made the film of Sphere, based on the Michael Crichton novel.
Yeah.
Which is a very... There's bits in the film I like, but it's overall a fairly creatively unsuccessful film. But the audio commentary is hilarious because they've recorded the actors separately. So they and they cut between them. Yeah. So there's this section. It's early on in the commentary where Dustin Hoffman goes on at length about how he really cared about the science fiction ideas in the film and what the message of the film was, and he thought that the entire cast needed to be on the same page. So I sat down, I worked out some thoughts, and I wrote them down and printed them out, a sort of a manifesto, if you will. And then they cut to when they've been doing the commentary with Samuel L. Jackson, who, of course, being Samuel L. Jackson, is fairly blunt.
Yeah.
And suddenly starts going, I don't know, Dustin Hoffman came in one day with his pile of paper that he said it was some kind of manifesto. I didn't read it, I just threw it in the bin. I don't care about that kind of bullshit. Yeah. They're just paying me to play some lines and I'm going to go and play some golf while we're not shooting. That's all I care about. Yeah. And the difference between the two of them is so funny. Hoffman takes his stuff so, so overly seriously. Yeah.
The other Mel Brooks story I heard, because I saw a recent live stage thing he did.
Yeah.
A Q&A kind of thing. Whereas he was making High Anxiety because he's doing a Hitchcock pastiche. And he goes and talks to Hitchcock about doing it. And him and Hitchcock scull out, you know, which parts of which movies you should have in the movie. And Hitchcock gave him the idea for the best joke ever that he didn't have the money to do for High Anxiety.
Yeah.
Which was, you have the main character, Roger Thorndike, running for a ferry, and the ferry's 10 feet away from the dock.
Yeah.
And he leaps and gets on the ferry and it pulls into the dock. And Mel Brooks said, I would love to have done that, but we didn't have the money to do it. But this is Hitchcock coming up with a beautiful visual gag.
Yeah, and he
saw the movie and didn't. He saw the movie at a previous screening that Mel Brooks did for him of High Anxiety.
Yeah.
Didn't say a word. Next day, Mel Brooks gets a crate of champagne from Alfred Hitchcock. There's all these stories of Hollywood you don't hear because people, you know, don't tell them. And Hitchcock had a wicked sense of humour. Yeah, he was a prick in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
But when it came to filmmaking, he could be generous at times. She'll be winded up anyway.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, I would like to thank the two remaining audience members I have. Really appreciate you sticking out the distance, and I'm glad that we were helping out the cats with your crocheting as well, Elaine. But anyway, please support both Fiction Machine on Patreon and Paleo Cinema and Martian Driving Podcast on Patreon. You've now heard what Grant copped for being a Patreon supporter. Shit ton of good stuff. Swag everywhere.
Awesome stuff.
Awesome stuff absolutely everywhere. And thank you for your time. And I've just got a 5-minute paddle which says that it's time to knock that naughty clock that says it's time to go. And again, I will see you guys next time with Martian Driving Podcast or Paleo Cinema Podcast. In the meantime, keep watching the skies, keep watching good movies, and don't hit anything with your car.